Nerds News Podcast. It's episode 4. I'm Croc Kamen, and with me, Editor-in-Chief...
It's Tom Holder.
Excellent. Last week, it went all right, all things said, really. I mean, it's a new project and all.
Yeah, definitely. It took a little bit of work on our end to get the audio quality right, but we're supposed to be pretty clear right about now, this time around.
Yes, I mean, I bought a headset... And unfortunately, it didn't work out of the box, so I'm back to internal microphone and apologise, but I shall, you know, again, sort that out next week. I have to go back to the shop and replace that. Thank you, Logitech.
Well, and I got a little, one of those Griffin iMic things for the Power Mac, so I got proper audio again this time. And so, you know, on my end, at least, everything should be working fine now, and Croc will look for something that works and that isn't called Logitech, and then probably we'll have, like, a full good audio quality on both sides. That should be really okay.
Mm. I think we should probably start each show with griping about something that prevents us from getting things working properly.
Well, then
last
we should
week
start...
it was AOL.
And this time it's going to be GarageBand, because I just know for sure that in about 10 to 15 minutes it's going to crash. I'm fairly sure about it. Just like last time.
Okay, so news-wise, what are we going to start with? Let me take a pick here, because I kept asking you to do your choices last week, so... when did you first use Linux? So, actually, quite an excellent question. I would say that I'm extremely new to Linux. I can't harken back as far as other people, like 1996. I mean, the first time I got on the internet was 1996. That was on a Windows 95 computer at school. But Linux-wise, all I can say as far as when I first used Linux is that I've used every beta and every release since Warty, which is 4, wasn't it? Number 4?
2004, I believe.
Warty War,
maybe. Yeah, I believe
something
that's 2004.
Like that. Relatively recent, and basically every you know beta release and final release that they've announced, I've downloaded the ISO, I've tried it out, and every single time it's had some horrendous failure that hasn't worked on my hardware, or hasn't worked in my VM, or just bad user experience. And every year it has got better, and I think that 8.11, I think that's Jaunty. Has probably been one of the first versions that's worked flawlessly out of the box. So, you know, they're getting there. But I think it still doesn't compare to what I'm used to, you know, Mac OS as far as, you know, just out of the box experience. But it's getting there, certainly.
Well, I think it really depends on well, obviously, on what hardware you have. Because I started out somewhere, well, 2001, 2002 with, I believe, like Mandrake 8 or 7 point something. I don't know. And I actually got it working back then. It was my first Linux experience. It was the only thing that it wouldn't do. There was something that it didn't do, and in the end, I found out using the internet how to solve it. And well, since then, I never really had like hardware problems or anything, mostly because I been using the same computer until this January when I finally bought a new one. So I knew the hardware on my machine like inside out, every detail, you know, monitors, refresh rates, everything, you know, from the top of my head, and I still do, by the way.
Yeah.
So for me, setting up Linux was easy because I knew every little detail and I knew exactly what to do, and you know, that didn't change all that much. And well, I kept using Mandrake until well about the time Ubuntu got popular, and then since then I've been using Ubuntu as the as my distribution. And I kind of been switching between the KDE variant, Kubuntu, and normal Ubuntu. And
yeah.
Usually I just grow sick of KDE and go back to GNOME, and then I'm sick of GNOME and go back to KDE, and that's kind of a little back and forth. And right now I'm on a well no Linux period because I'm not really using any Linux at this moment. But I just kind of switched between the two. So, but overall, Linux has gotten so much better in the past 8-9 years that I've been using it. It's really, you know, astounding that, you know, like a community project can do something like that. I think that's really a testament to that, you know, open source can definitely work, and it does work, you know. But, you know, you have to be lucky with the kind of hardware that you have, and, you know, and everybody has bad experiences with one thing or the other. Like this week, I've been having some bad experience with macOS, for instance, you know, so it's not perfect every time, every, you know, it really depends on how you use a machine and what you do with it and what kind of hardware you have.
Yeah, I'm willing to forgive hardware not working and things like that. I mean, it means that I can't really switch over to using it, but I've always been forgiving it when I've been trying it. What my complaint with Linux has been over all these years, and whilst it's certainly been improving even on the hardware front, is that the user experience is kind of... overlooked, or many of the distribution maintainers are blind to many user experience issues I've had in Ubuntu, doing very basic, you know, first time user tasks, and I've had blank error messages, or error messages that have command line strings in them and just extremely cryptic. And I'm throwing these up within 5 minutes of just using the computer on, you know, a normal basis. And so the user experience is what's been lacking in Linux, and it is getting better. Certainly Jaunty and the upcoming 9.04 is very, very good. It's just a much higher level of polish. And I think actually one of the earlier distributions I used was SUSE 9. And that was running KDE, and that was just an absolutely horrendous user experience. I just thought it nice and powerful. Sure, it can do a huge, but KDE is just eclectic and so many billions of options and completely unforgiving and unfriendly.
KDE is really for a, well, GNOME is for a certain type of person, and so is KDE. But in the end, KDE takes more work, especially the KDE 3. That took a lot of work, but it was so... I actually thought that the flexibility, even though it could hinder new users, but overall, if you really dove into it, because my first experience with Linux was KDE, because Mandrake was a KDE distribution. But once you're really into it, and you kind of know where everything is, you can really tailor it specifically to your needs. And that's a point that, you know, Mac OS X can't offer you, GNOME can't offer you, and Windows can't offer you. So it really, again, it depends on what kind of person you are. So if you really like that control, KDE 3 was, especially the later versions, like KDE 3.5, it was, you know, it was near perfection in that it gave you so much control. But that kind of control, you know, it's also a danger for some other users, because they just want to get work done and they don't want to have to fiddle with everything to get everything working, you know. So it depends on what kind of person you are, on whether you think KDE is bad
also
or whether you think GNOME is bad,
or the
other way
around. Depends on the distributor as well, the people putting together the distribution, because there's so much level of customization. I haven't tried KDE 4 yet, but I'm waiting for a good distribution to be able to try that out and to see what really, you know, what that can do in a good usage. Because I've got one of my experiences with Linux as well, as I bought an EPC 701. My mum uses that for browsing eBay, etc., and things like that, and that's got a Zandros default distribution, and that is a horrendous, you know, piece of work. That's just, you know, an example of doing things shoddy. And it's the same Linux or Windows, all OEMs are, you know, perfectly capable of ruining it.
Yeah, but that's when we're touching the subject of netbooks now on Linux. But, you know, Linux on netbooks is perfect. You know, Linux is perfectly capable of delivering a very good user experience on a netbook. It's just that the OEMs are just really messing that one up. I mean, I have an Acer Aspire 1, and while the interface looked like it looked really, you know, clean and it looked like it worked very well, but I believe it's still right now using like Firefox 2.0 or something. It the updates aren't regularly. The interfaces for configuring the hardware are very, very limited, you know. So the first, you know, the most often asked question by people who buy the Linux version of the Aspire 1 is how on earth they're going to get rid of that horrendous Limpus thing, that Limpus abomination even, that Acer put on there. It's just really, really bad. And I think that you know, it's not only the fault of the manufacturers, but also of what I call the Linux community, even though that's of course very diverse and probably won't really cover everything.
Yeah, anonymous group X.
Yeah, there should be more communication between the distributors and the manufacturers. In that, not that the so that the OEMs don't have to talk to each individual distributor, but that there's somehow one platform or one place where they can go, where there are people who are not affiliated necessarily with one particular distribution, but who are just specialists in this whole Linux thing in general, and it can just help the OEMs, no matter the distribution, to properly tailor everything and make everything working. Because Microsoft has been doing that for a very long time, and it has been doing that relatively well, not always, of course. That's something that the Linux community still needs to learn, you know, just to step outside of the distribution boundaries and start working together, not to create a single distribution, but just to make things easier for manufacturers. I think that's very, very important.
They have
right
got
now
to make it easier, because the manufacturers and OEMs they are geared up. Their entire manufacturing system is geared up to Windows, and so they need the helping hand when it comes to be able to, you know, a good Linux distribution and tailor it properly. I mean, you take the example of the HP MiniNote and the customized interface on that. That's an example of, you know, good Linux user experience. But that's HP, you know, going out of their way to do that. That's that kind of company. But you can't expect the same out of Acer or Asus, etc.
No, because they're Acer is kind of a different kind of company than HP. Acer is more of the lower end, you know, and they can offer some good stuff there. But you know, it's not they're not really they don't have the money to spend. Well, they, maybe they have, but then their prices will go up, and that's not their market. But you know, the Dell machines running Ubuntu have also gotten some pretty good reviews, because you know that's basically like the Ubuntu has really has been tailored towards the towards those machines, and Canonical has actually helped in doing that, and HP just did it by themselves. So it is definitely possible to create a good Linux user experience. It's just that for some, especially some smaller companies, that's just really a difficult thing to do, because it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of effort. You know, they probably only have Windows engineers on board, so it's really a shift in everything, and they have to relearn a lot of things. So, and I think the community could really help out on that one, if at least the parent companies of the various distributors, you know, like Novel and Canonical, etc., Red Hat. But that's definitely something that they should focus on to make it better, because it, yeah, it is really possible for Linux to get some good foot in the door on that end. Yeah. They just need, you know, to put in some little effort, you know, and effort and from the UMS, but also from the community itself, definitely.
Yes, well, we've got to think that the topic we're discussing is obviously the first time we've used Linux. Well, these netbooks are going to be the first time that many people have used Linux. This is going to be their first experience, yeah. So it's critical that you know, the Linux community is pushing to get this experience right, and that shipping crap like you know, the EPC 701 Zandros distribution, which is still stuck on Firefox 2 and will be, you know, ad infinitum, is not acceptable. Yeah. They need to pressurize, you know, the original equipment manufacturers, as well as helping them to correct those issues.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, definitely.
Okay, we're going to pass on to the next topic. I think about time we let you choose the next topic.
Yeah, okay, well, what could we talk about? Let me see.
I should say.
Let's talk about the let's talk about BIMTOP, the
oh,
desktop,
yes, of course.
Edition that the I think that's really interesting.
I mean,
really,
do you say interesting like an art teacher says interesting, or, you know, interesting, you know?
I say probably as someone who would really like to see more innovative ideas in, at least to, for people, and especially the larger companies like Microsoft and Apple, to actually try something new instead of just, you know, because essentially whatever environment you're using, Genome, to a lesser extent KDE4, because they have been trying some really new and interesting things there, but especially like Windows, macOS 10, and Genome, they're basically three exactly the same environments with a little bit of changes, a little bit of, you know, differences here and there, but essentially they're the same. And if you can use macOS 10, you can use Windows and you can use Genome. It's really, you know, it doesn't really matter. There's nothing new. There aren't a lot of companies that are really trying to take the existing experience or the existing paradigm that we're using today and make it better. And at least, you know, the guys behind BIMTOP, at least they're trying. I don't think that they succeeded, but they're trying in any case, and I think that's a major plus, you know. So I really wanted also on West News to give them some extra attention, because that's the kind of thing that I want to see in the desktop world, you know, people trying something new. I mean, that's really important in my view. And it may not work, because I don't think adding a third dimension, or even if you think logically about adding a third dimension, you're only going to realize that it's not going to work on a 2D plane, which is a display, and a 2D input device, which is your mouse. So, you know, you can realize that it can't work, but, you know, that's experimenting for you. You won't, if you experiment, you're going to fail, but
yeah,
you know, at least you tried. And I think that's important.
Yeah, these sort of things can all act towards underswell. They don't necessarily succeed, or they may not even be a good way of doing things, but nonetheless it's showing that there's a demand for change there, or that people are trying to rethink this. I thought I wrote an article for Us News a long time ago that covered this whole idea of moving to has AR finally become a reality? Well, you know, with this trying to move to 3D, we're not changing the mouse, so we're inherently stuck. Unless we change the mouse, we'll never get away from 2D. You can put a 2D 3D in, but it's never as efficient as a 2D. So you lose too much trying to go to these, you know, 3D or pseudo 3D systems over the high precision of a mouse. And that's why we're stuck.
Yeah, well, the thing is, though, that, you know, it may look like 3D, you know, it may look like a computer game or anything or something, but still, it's just a 2D desktop with a few vantage points and a few, you know, like lines running towards the back, and that somehow is supposed to give you the sense that you're using a 3D environment, but you're not. It's just, I don't know, it's just really weird. Even when you're trying to use it, I mean, it's incredibly cool, and the physics engine that powers everything and, like, items bumping into one another, it's awesome. But, you know, it's just to sum up the problems, you know, you're using a 2D display, you're using a 2D input device, and you're trying to shove 2D user interface elements like windows and icons and documents. You're trying to turn those into 3D objects, but they are not. They're inherently two-dimensional. A window is a two-dimensional object. There's no depth. There's no, you know, yeah. You can add like some shallow depth, like a compass, for instance, does where they move, or, you know, like shadows. But it only adds like a you know, just an illusion
to make it any
to make them appear 3D. But they're not 3D. No, and you know, but even when you like I said at the start of the discussion, you know, I mean, even if you think about it logically, it's it immediately becomes obvious that it will only make things more complicated, because even, you know, right now people have to deal with two dimensions. So something can be to the left, to the right, and up and down, and, you know, every combination possible. And now somehow they also have to think about to the front and to the back, you know. So it adds just more place to put stuff, and therefore makes things harder to find. If you have two, if you have to find something, and in your entire apartment you only have two drawers to look in, you know, you're going to find it. But if you have 10 million drawers, it's only going to make the search process much more complicated. So even when you think about it logically, you can realize that, you know, 3D interfaces in, you know, in the current time period where we are now, it's just not going to work. It's pretty obvious to me.
I think really a change in hardware needs to come about before we finally escape the sort of mouse scenario. And I think we're seeing that kind of a bit with the iPhone and now multi-touch and touchscreen and stuff like that. Whilst that's probably not going to be taken up mainstream on computers, because again, you've got the benefits of a keyboard, people are at least rethinking UI as far as iPhone is concerned. And so maybe we will come along with, touchscreens that are, have feedback to them, so that you can type directly onto the screen and it, you know, you get the responsiveness.
Well, you know, I don't, a lot of people just about the iPhone, that it's somehow new and revolutionary, but I don't see the iPhone, like the way you input stuff on the iPhone. I don't think it's a revolution, but it's an evolution. Touchscreens have existed
for,
you know, like,
it's been around for
10 million years, you know, and it's, yeah, and no, but just, you know, even touchscreen devices have been, you know, we've been selling and been doing well, relatively, not of course really well, but relatively well. The big change that Apple introduced is like the multi thing, you know, that you can use multiple fingers and gestures and everything. But it's still, it's an evolution,
well,
not a revolution.
It's coming in,
you know,
7 as well.
Isn't
it? Windows 7 has got multi-touch ability built in, given the correct hardware as well.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. So it is. It is getting more popular, but I'm not entirely sure if it's right now. It may work on a phone, but what it would work for is like the Surface thing that Microsoft showed. I think that's like a really cool application where they really thought, well, how can we make a device or something, or a computer, or, well, a device that's built around multi-touch and where multi-touch makes sense. The iPhone is the same kind of device. Take multi-touch and put it somewhere where it makes sense. Surface, same thing. Or like the large display that I believe it was CNN that used it during the elections in the United States last year, where they had a big display made by Perceptive Pixel, where they could, you know, zoom into specific states or specific regions within each state and show the results. And that's where it really works. But I'm not sure if it will work on a, I'm looking at my display right now. And while it would be like cool to, you know, move my fingers on it, I don't really see an additional value at this point. I mean,
this brings us back to the issue of operating systems, is that if we don't have an you can't shoehorn current operating systems into this new paradigm or new technology. It doesn't fit. You have to have a new operating starting from the beginning. And the issue is that are we going to ever escape from a 2D desktop when we have too much legacy in current form of Windows and current operating systems? You've got your Microsoft Word and you've got all your programs in your stored and everything like that. If we wanted to adopt this new sort of multi-touch technology, we would have to just dump the entire existing history of computing and start again in order to get rid of the legacy of Windows, because you can't have a completely multi-touch only operating system and hardware, of course, that's the important thing to say, that then also can support the legacy stuff, because then you're trying to make you're limiting, then, in order to try and support legacy, you're limiting how effectively you are going to be going forward. We're stuck with these operating systems.
Yeah, well, especially if you look at Yeah, because all the little user interface widgets are, you know, geared towards a mouse, so they're relatively small. I mean, I'm looking at my OS X desktop right now. You know, while the dock, for instance, could work, you know, even if I had to remove a window, I'd have to like use my pinky and then the nail on my pinky to, you know, to select the little red orb. You know, it's not going to work. There needs to be, you're right in that sense, that it really needs to you'd need to rework everything from the ground up, and I don't think that's worth the effort because I don't think. You know, why would I want to lift my hands from the table? You know, it's an RSE nightmare, you know, a repetitive strain injury nightmare to, you know, move my fingers over the screen, which I'm doing right now, and the people walking outside will probably think I'm stupid, but, you know, it looks really weird, and it's not very natural, you know, on like a big display like this. I don't think it's going to work. I mean, it's nice that Windows 7 includes it, and maybe, you know, Microsoft can astound us and deliver some really cool applications that make use of it. But, you know, I don't think that on the regular tasks you do with your computer, like emailing, browsing, and, you know, writing a document, whatever, I don't think it's going to work in that area. Maybe in photo manipulation that it could be useful, like, for instance, when you want to pan, like, a really large document or video or whatever. But I don't think it's going to work on, well, just about any use that we have now. Maybe in games. I also thought of that, like, for instance, like, real-time strategy games where you can, you know, move your units around with your hands. I think that could be pretty cool. But that's about it. I mean, and I don't think that's enough to justify buying a completely new screen or a completely new computer with touch built in, which will probably be relatively expensive. You know.
Hang on a second. Yes, with 7, it is a 99%, it's a mouse-based interface. So adding these things on, as nice as they are, is really, if anything, detrimental or completely useless or pure and utter gimmick. Because the UI is all entirely mouse-centric, and the best that they can add is just simple gestures. And I would say that even with photo manipulation, you can say that, yeah, that would be good for photo manipulation, but how are they going to write this software to be both mouse input-based and, you know, touch interface as well? If you have to keep juggling your hands between the mouse and the screen, it's not all that very effective. Things have to be designed 100% completely with the input method at heart, and to just dump the mouse in completely. I mean, what I'd like to see with 7, or what I'd like to see Microsoft do, is to release a piece of software, a bit like ArtRage or something like that, but done completely with a touch screen, and just forget the mouse. Have a program that shows using the touch screen as a touch screen and not as some sort of go-between your normal user interface.
Well, I think that's going to happen because, you know, when Windows 7 comes out, it'll have a multi-touch framework. Every computer that ships will have at least the framework, the software, and in place. You know, and then, of course, it will take some time before the hardware side is implemented. But, you know, that's going to trigger a lot of, you know, especially like independent and small software houses to develop software that is specifically tailored towards touch. So at least, you know, Microsoft is putting the frameworks, you know, is making the ball rolling on the desktop end. Apple at least did it on the... you know, on the mobile end, of course, and then, you know, Microsoft is at least providing. It may not work for everything, but at least they're providing the ingredients for, you know, developers with new ideas to say, well, hell, maybe we can make like a really good, I don't know, Twitter client or something using touch, or a really good audio player with touch. At least, you know, it gives them the opportunity to do so, because right now, you know, even if you have innovative touch ideas, you know, OS X doesn't have a framework for that yet. Linux doesn't have a framework for that, but, you know, Windows 7 is, well, probably going to be the first operating system that has that framework in place. So if there are now, thanks to the iPhone, there are probably people out there who have ideas for the desktop and multi-touch, and they're going to try it, you know, on Windows 7, because that's going to be the first place to start, because that's the first operating system with the framework built in, and probably some APIs and everything ready to, you know, to design your application. I think that's it's a good move by Microsoft, not necessarily because it's going to be useful for 99% of the people, but it is giving at least a little head start towards those that want to, you know, work with it, and I think that's good.
Absolutely. Okay, I think we're finished with that. Moving on. There's a lot of Linux news on the homepage in sort of various different forms. You've got the Zool stuff, you've got it's just everywhere, really. Build your own Linux distro. Let's try something a bit different here, not technically operating system related. The plans for Firefox 3.6 is what they've started to call it, Firefox.next.
Yeah, or it had another name like Namoroka, but let's just call it 3.6. That's a little easier to pronounce. Well, if I may start, I'm at least happy that they're really going to try and work on the responsiveness of the application, because if there's one thing that I really hate Firefox for, it's how slow it is, especially the interface. Especially, you know, if you want to just look at the difference between loading, Chrome or Firefox on a Windows machine. And I have a really powerful Windows machine, and loading a Firefox window just takes too long. And for me, browsing is a really simple, minimalistic experience. And I just, when I click the browser button, you know, the browser icon, I want it to be right there, like, you know, like a finger snap. It should be there. I shouldn't have to wait. And I'm really happy that, you know, the Firefox developers see that there's a problem too, and are really going to work on that. So I think that's really, really important. So I'm happy with that in any case.
Yes, I should say to readers, in case they don't know, Firefox 3 is the current version. 3.1 was going to be the next version, but they decided to bump that up to 3.5, a bit like 1.5, because they feel that there's many different, too many improvements to just call it a 0.1. There's the new JavaScript engine, for example, in there, and so the version afterwards on the current trunk is called 3.6, but technically that's going to become Firefox 4. In the long run, within a year and a half or something like that. I mean, Firefox has been one very interesting story, and it's kind of strange to be in this position where we're only on Firefox version 3. I mean, what's the future going to be like when we're on Firefox version 10, etc.? Because it's a relatively new project and it's changed the internet so much. I mean, we can't deny that it's fundamentally changed the browser market.
Yeah, definitely. It is, you know, I'm also not saying that like it's a bad browser or anything. It's just not my thing, you know. It's really
Of
good, and
course.
it really, you know, it really broke, Internet Explorer's terrible hold on the internet, so to speak. And it really did that very well. And it is a really good browser, especially, you know, with all the extensions and everything that it can offer, and the flexibility. And of course, it's open source, which is always good. So, you know, it's really a good project. It's just not for me. I don't need all the extra bits and stuff bolted on top. And, you know, I just need a really simple thing that shows me, that leaves as much screen space for showing the actual browser content, and that's it. I don't really care about anything else. And I think Chrome does that better than Firefox, at this point at least, than Firefox does. So, yeah.
Yes, it's like now that Firefox has matured, it's got, how can it keep becoming something new? Does it necessarily need to keep becoming something new? Now that we've got diversity in the browser market, I mean, would Chrome even exist if Firefox hadn't existed in the first place, given that in 2003 Internet Explorer usage was 99.7%? You know, that's the severity of the Microsoft, Internet Explorer monopoly, that there was no room for anybody else. And we wouldn't have the likes of Chrome if it wasn't for Firefox. But now Firefox is in this position. You know, people do, one of the things they harp on a lot about Firefox, or they have this concern, is bloat. You know, how much more can you add to this browser before you're missing really the point and or the original success story of Firefox?
Yeah, because the original goal, if I'm not entirely sure, but if I recall correctly, the original reason Firefox actually came into existence was because people thought that the Mozilla suite was becoming too bloated and too big and too too
It was
encompassing. And
started by Joe Hewitt and Ross Blake. Was it Blake Ross? I keep forgetting the guy's name. And basically, they took the current trunk of Mozilla. They created And welcome back. Okay. Yes, we've hit that bug in GarageBand again. It basically appears to be that the little it runs out of RAM. There must be a leak in GarageBand somewhere, and it runs out of RAM displaying the little waveforms in the audio recordings, and then just crashes, and I lose the data. So that's fantastic. But anyway, getting back, I was talking about Phoenix. I was just saying that the project was started to strip down the Mozilla suite to just a browser as minimum as possible, and that's what Firefox 1 really was. It was just a browser, and it shows this. Surprising how effective that was, how the branding, how everything came together, how it being a light program, it was a real marketing success, and the Mozilla suite never got past a couple of million people in all the years that it existed.
Yeah, but you know it, and I, you know, firmly believe that if you really, if you ask people what they want is one program to do one thing and to do that one thing well. And I don't think that people want like Mozilla suites. I think that's actually one of the reasons why in most places in the world, Opera isn't doing very well. Yeah. And I think it isn't doing very well because it tries to do too much and that intimidates people, you know. And I don't mean it in a belittling way because I'm exactly the same, you know. And I could be called, you know, like a bit of a technology guy. And I have the exact same... you know, idea towards software. I want software to do one thing and to do one thing well. Of course, that, you know, may not work for more complicated pieces of software, you know, like office suites and that sort of thing. But when I look at the more simpler applications, you know, like chat clients, Twitter clients, email clients, and browsers, I just want them to be as simple as possible so that I don't get distracted by all sorts of other nonsense. Because,
yeah.
You know, if you have a really complicated application that does 10 million things at once, if it crashes, you know, 10 million things at once will crash and you'll have to, you know, figure that one out. Well, if it's just one thing that it does, you know, just browsing, the browser crashes and that's it. But you don't lose your email client, you don't lose your torrent client, you don't lose this, you don't lose that, you just lose the browser. You know, and in Chrome it's of course even better because you just lose one tab, but you know, that's the next step in browser evolution. So, you know, and I really think that in that sense Firefox really, you know, understood that, you know, back then, like around about 10 years ago, I believe. It really understood that, you know, it needed to be simple and in my opinion, it kind of lost its ways, you know. It really started to include more and more and more and more, you know, and I don't think that's the right way to go, at least not for me. But, you know, the rest of the world doesn't seem to care because Firefox is doing really, really, really well. And that's good because, you know, the more competition, the better, that's always. And it, as you already said, it really opened the doors for everyone else to come in and innovate, you know, Safari, first on the Mac and later on Windows, despite the horrible interface change in Safari 4, but, you know, that's another story. And you know, and of course for Chrome, which I really think is it isn't the new Firefox, but at least it is the first browser to have a similar sort of impact. You know, to really focus on performance and stability, and of course also security with the sandbox model and everything. So you know, and it really helped refocus the browser makers on things that they hadn't been focusing on very well as of late, you know, and I think that's also very good.
It's very interesting to note that the guy behind the UI in Chrome is Ben Guja, and he's a Google engineer but also worked for Mozilla before, and he's the one that did most, well, he did a lot of the UI in Firefox, particularly version 2. He redesigned the options dialog. And he moved over to doing Chrome project at Google, and you know, he was really ahead of that UI of just really cramming of trimming down things down, and it really feels like that he was coming across too many frustrations in the Mozilla project due to its open nature, but he couldn't get rid of, you know, he couldn't just cut the slack because there's too many people that say, you know, argue this and that, you know, we need this, or you know, and Chrome is one of those browsers where they're really, you know, just slaughtered a lot of UI for the sake of trying to get down to simplicity. And that's one of the things I don't like about Firefox, is that over time they are losing the balls to make decisions and cut UI or to make something for certain. And there are many issues, many UI pieces of UI in Firefox that I really wish that they would just sort out or cut. And there doesn't seem to be, or doesn't appear to be, there probably is, of course, because there's such a large community and there are many spirited people in Mozilla, but there doesn't appear to be the UI guy that, you know, demanding where Firefox should go and where it should be and having that vision. That doesn't seem to be there just at this moment. And I would like to see some of that come forward in the Mozilla blogs of steering the UI somewhere with the next version of Firefox.
Well, that, I think that's a problem that many browsers are facing because, you know, it, as you already explained, you know, Firefox has it, but, you know, let's not even start about the interface of Internet Explorer. You know, even the new version, it might be like the next best thing since sliced bread, but I'm not ever, ever going to use that interface. I'm just going to stop talking about it. And then we have Opera, which is, it's gotten better, but it's still, you know, it's also a bit convoluted, you know.
Because it
tries to do a lot of things. And, you know, Safari was always a very simple interface until they introduced that really stupid task, title, bar, thing, whatever it is. And Chrome really is like the simple browser, you know. It's just a window frame and the tabs are on it and there are like three buttons and that's it, you know. But it still does its job really well. And I think that's, you know, that's awesome. I really like that, you know.
Yes. Do you remember the news about Higgs Design being hired by Opera to sort out their UI, basically? Higgs. You know Higgs Design, the person who's basically behind... they did the Firefox. I think he did the Firefox logo, original Firefox logo, or was that someone else? But this is a very important UI guy. I can't remember off the top of my head now, unfortunately, but I've got a whole bunch of bookmarks that we're there to look all this up. But it's a very, very important UI guy, and it's been hired by Opera to look at the
Recently
the UI.
Or for recently or for versions that are...
I've got the blog up here. It was November 2008.
Oh, so we're probably going to see the fruits of that labor in the coming, months, right?
Opera 10 is in alpha at the moment, so the UI stuff probably won't go in until, you know, beta or later, and hopefully we'll, you know... I'm really hoping that they do sort the UI out on Opera, because I think on the PC it's okay, but on Mac it's just unacceptable.
Yeah, on the Mac it's definitely on the Mac, but also on Linux I think it's actually worse than on the Windows side.
Really?
Of course, you can customize everything, but you know, I don't want to customize a browser. You know, I just want it to be there and work. That's it.
Okay, I think that silence probably signals that we want to move on.
Probably.
Okay. Okay, I think we're going to do a bit of meta. We received a couple of emails about the podcast, which we're very thankful. If you've got any comments, please, of course, send them to osnews-crew@osnews.com. The email is on the website as well. We've got one here that says from Mr. Merwin, which Tom thinks is an awesome name. And it says, "Hey, Croc, I think it's a great idea, but you need to work on it a bit more. I like the fresh, spontaneous sound feel of the podcast. Don't lose that. But Tom's mic is a bad case of mic feedback. We hope that's solved now, of course, because Tom's got his
headset and everything, and I've got everything worked out. We've got most of the audio issues worked out here, yeah.
Yeah, I still need to sort out a headset on my end, but again, mine wasn't as bad as yours was before,
no,
so thankfully
exactly.
Better survive. I'm sure you know this by now. I like the Skype suggestion in the comments. Skype's quality has improved tremendously. I've not got any real experience of actual Skype recording. I mean, Skype itself is you know, perfectly fine. But I think really the reason we're doing this iChat is that you've got multi-track recording. It's easy to record in GarageBand. You know, you don't have to purchase any extra software or anything.
Yeah, so right now we have a little trick where where Croc is recording his own voice on his computer, so he has really good quality, and I'm recording in his own track, of course, and then I'm recording my voice in a track here on my Mac in GarageBand, and I can send him my track, you know, and he can import that into his track, you know, line everything up, and then we should probably have like a quality like we're sitting next to each other, so that should be that's really good, and I'm not sure if Skype can. It's integrated as well with GarageBand as iChat, so you know we could try it, but you know I'm not really sure if there's any benefit at this point. So you know.
Yeah, it says, have you looked into Wiretap Studio to handle your recording? I mean, it's along like the Skype issue. You can use other programs to record, but really, in order to keep the spontaneity of this, we want to keep editing down to a minimal. So being able to record into GarageBand means that I'm not having to handle more than one piece of software. I'm not also having to do interstitial edits, etc., as I go from one program to another. The program that I'm recording with is the program that I edit with. I can cut out a small bit and then just cut to an MP3. So it keeps up the spontaneity by keeping this as simple as possible. I think what we've got works already. But if you have got any other suggestions, keep them coming. Email continues. Also, the concept that you need to register and logging gives the impression that the podcast/OS news is what is important here, not the user's feedback. Quite contrary to the view you expressed during your podcast. So I think he's saying that we're very opinionated.
No, I think what he means is that, you know, of course, on OS News, like 5 years ago or something, I don't even remember. It was a big kerfuffle back then that we, made registration mandatory in order to comment. And he's probably not a regular reader, but he did like the podcast, so, and he wanted to give a comment, but he has to register, you know, and I think that's kind of a problem. Well, you know, I understand his your problem, Merwin, but commenting is, we made it mandatory to register for the reason that, you know, anonymous posting was a total mess on OS News. You know, there were, it was abused too much, so that's why we introduced the registration system, and later on we made it mandatory in order to comment, because it gave us a lot more control over, you know, who we could ban, or, you know, like to fight spam and everything. So you know, we really don't, we are never going to bring back anonymous posting. But you do have a good point. It is a bit weird, maybe, you know, that we're, you know, being all open here and everything, but you have to register the comment. So, you know, probably the only solution that I have is or to register or to send an email, which you did. So, you know, it's that's not really a problem that we can solve right now.
Yeah, feel free to send an email. You know, it's certainly going to be read. Yes. Yeah, so I read that wrong. I thought you said logging. I said meant log in. Spelled that wrong in the email. That's perfectly fine.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Anyway, that's fantastic. So we want to move on to the next email.
Let me see. His name is Andreas Ertelt. I'm not entirely sure where he's from, but I think that would probably be something like Germany. I don't know. You know, correct me if I'm wrong. He starts his email with, for short, I really enjoyed the show. Well, we're really thankful for that, of course. Sadly, there were only a few, or was it just one, OS news topics discussed. The floppy insertion detection was a really nice pick, and the idea of using SD cards as floppy replacement and naming a drive A was just brilliantly funny. Well, that credit goes to Croc, of course. Maybe some April 1st roundup would have been nice, as well as the plans of Genome 3.0. Well, it's always going to be a little bit of a, you know, I don't really know actually what you mean, Andreas, by OS news topics. Do you mean topics that are strictly related to operating systems, or do you mean topics that are, you know, have been mentioned on OS news? Because if I recall correctly, the last time every topic we discussed was also a news item, right? Or am I wrong? Do you remember, Croc?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we were using as our show notes, as it was, just looking at what's on the homepage and picking things out of. And that's exactly what we're doing here today. I'm not sure what he's saying really, but I suppose also we weren't prepared. You know, this was literally done within the span of 4 hours of just preparing of completely ad hoc, as we had said. I think that as we go on doing this, we're going to get better. So the important thing is with a podcast, I think, with any podcast, is always just to how do they say it in open source, isn't it? It's release early, release often. Just get it out there. It will improve over time. You know, it take a podcast is a very natural thing. It's not something that you're going to do ultra polished right from the start. So, you know, hopefully we'll improve over time. And so just be patient with us, really, I think, as far as that.
Yeah, okay. Well, the next part of the email reads, after I was about halfway through, it kind of felt like a TV book discussion or talk show, not meant negatively. Maybe going in that direction might be a nice idea. Having a moderator, maybe the author of the particular news, and a couple of people, or will it just stay you two, who discuss the topics, giving them a personal touch. Well, the idea is definitely to bring in other OS news editors. Both David and, you know, David Adams, the owner, and Jordan Spencer Cunningham, which is one of our other editors. They both, you know, expressed the interest to join us. They couldn't join us this weekend because David was away and Jordan didn't have the time this week. But we also, you know, Croc and me also want to include more people, definitely, than just the two of us, because that's probably going to be boring in the end. And having having the other editors on board as well would be really cool. Maybe even, you know, in the future, if all this keeps working out so well, maybe we could include some regular readers who want to, you know, phone in and give their opinion. So, you know, that's definitely something I would want to look at.
Well, in fact, actually, we've got to think about this, because unfortunately next week I am away on the weekend, so we'll have to do it either a different day or get someone else in. I mean, I would particularly like to hear sort of Adam Scheinberg's, is that how I say that? I don't know. His opinion as well, because, you know, he's the web developer on the site, he's pretty opinionated as well, so that all helps. Okay. But yeah, I would just as much likely like to get other people involved or get the readership involved as well.
Yeah, and the final part is, you know, better recording quality would improve the show further. Well, we've already addressed that a couple of times. And, you know, he says the microphones, audio codecs used for the initial recording didn't seem like the best choice, smiley face. Well, obviously, you know, we know that. That wasn't, you know, exactly the best thing that we could do. And good luck and looking forward to the next show. Well, that's today, so, you know, you don't have to look forward anymore. And that leaves us with the last email, I think. Or do you want to say something about that, or what?
Well, I just noticed one thing. When he said codecs, I think he was probably meaning about OGG and things like that. You know, that we published this in just an MP3 file. And well, people are asking about, you know, if it's possible we can do this OGG. And myself as well, I thought, well, technically, podcast-wise, it would be better to do it as an AAC file, because you can do bookmarks, you can do art, and you can do all sorts of extras and things like that. But, of course, that's just not really open enough, given OS News' sort of readership.
Yeah, well, I think we should just for now stick with MP3, also because of, you know, like bandwidth issues and space issues on the server, because, you know, we'd have to double the amount of server space that we're using. And in the end, I mean, I understand, you know, personally, I would also prefer if we could use a truly open format like ARC, but the reality of things is that we also want people to be able to listen to this. And in that sense, MP3 simply is simply, you know, MP3 is the practical choice right now. It's not maybe not like the moral choice, so to speak, but it is the practical choice. So, you know, I think that's, you know, for now, that's going to be it. Maybe in the future, if we have also can also talk a bit with the people who actually own the OS News server and who are managing it, maybe, you know, it won't be that big of a deal to double the space for each podcast to also include an ARC version. But we'd have to talk about that. But for now, I think MP3 is just a simple practical choice, the best choice.
Okay, right. I think we're all finished here. We're going to wrap up. We just need to finish with some meta. As said before, we would welcome emails from you if you could send them to osnews-crew@osnews.com. That's also on the website. And of course, there'll be the news topic for this posted on the website on the homepage so that you can comment directly on the website. So, and also, you know, if you don't want to talk about the podcast itself, talk about the actual topics, you know, raised and correct us by all means.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you can always correct us. I mean, we're just people, and you know, we make mistakes, or or maybe we have really stupid opinions, and you really want to, you know, get out the pitchforks and the torches and burn us down. Well, you know, do it. I mean, that's what this is for, right? That's what the internet is for. So, you know, that's okay.
Okay, this is Croc Cayman signing off.
And Tom Howard signing off. See you probably next week.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.